Welcome back. This is Commercial Conversation number 14. I'm Gary Parr, Editorial Director of Commercial Building Products Magazine. And this week our topic, or this podcast, our topic is acoustics in healthcare facilities. To help us better understand the issues that are involved with healthcare and acoustics, we're pleased to have with us Dr. Gary Medeiros, who is Director of Making Hospitals Quiet Program at Rockfon, which is a Milton, Ontario, Canada-based company. He has 18 years of broad experience in the building industry as an acoustician, architect, educator, and innovator of building products. Dr. Medeiros has worked on a wide variety of project types, including educational, cultural, civic, judicial, hospitality, worship, corporate, residential, and entertainment facilities. Doesn't leave much out. He currently focuses on the effects of sound quality in the U.S. healthcare industry and individual patient recovery. As director of the Making Hospitals Quiet program, he leads a team of soundscape specialists addressing noise problems that plague U.S. hospitals. His work in acoustics has earned him the Robert B. Newman Award for Merit in Architectural Acoustics and a Research Award from the Institute of Noise Control Engineering. Dr. Medeiros, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's good to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
This is a fun topic. As a former teacher, I really have an appreciation for acoustics and the impact that they have on listeners and students in my case, but I'm sure that in the healthcare world, it's even more important. I know one of the things whenever you hear people telling horror stories of their experiences in hospitals, one thing I always note is that always in any conversation is complaints about noise, particularly at night when they're trying to sleep and, you know, after a surgery or something when they just want quiet and rest. And one of the things that happens to me is I hear people talking is I wonder how much of that noise is perceived and how much of it is real. Is there a real difference there in terms of what is really happening in hospitals? Is there a lot of perceived noise, or is it mostly real?
Actually, both. But perception definitely is the driving factor here. Patients in an acute setting, that's what we typically refer to as a hospital, take a national survey produced by Medicare. And it's a survey about their patient experience. And one of the questions is, how quiet was the area around your room at night? It's the lowest scoring, consistently the lowest scoring metric evaluated using that survey. And this survey is important because Medicare bases its financial reimbursements to hospitals now, as of October 1st, 2012, on the scores of that survey. So if I'm a hospital and I'm scoring low on this survey and perhaps noise is my lowest score, I'm getting less money reimbursed for my care to Medicare patients than, for example, a hospital 5 miles away who is scoring well on that survey.
So it's the old thing that the best way to affect change then is to put money on top of it.
Correct. And that's new. I mean, noise in healthcare has been a problem for centuries, if not longer. Only now that it's being equated directly to financial reimbursements is it becoming a much more urgent priority. In fact, the Barrel Institute, which is the leading organization in the United States for patient experience executives in healthcare facilities, does a biannual benchmarking study. They did it in 2011 and 2013 and asked in 2011 around 600 or 700 healthcare professionals, and in 2013 over 1,000 healthcare professionals, what are your top three priorities? And one of the top three priorities is improving the patient experience. And then they asked, what is your primary way or goal for improving patient experience in the coming years? And people wrote in, not even multiple choice, noise reduction. So both in 2011 and 2013, all of these healthcare professionals says noise reduction is their number one priority for improving patient experience.
That's okay, so there is some research behind that, but you're still basing an awful lot of this on patient subjective perception.
Correct.
Are there things that put some objectivity to it? I mean, is there some research? Is there something that makes it more objective rather than just how patients feel?
The questions that are on that survey, the national survey that patients take, are on there because the research shows a strong relationship between those events and medical outcomes and medical costs. This whole concept of surveying about the patient experience is a way to decrease our nation's Medicare costs. There's a big gap between Medicare revenues and expenditures, and this is part of our government's method for decreasing that gap. And what the research shows is that a patient that consistently experiences noise, their cost of care goes up, and the quality of the medical medical outcome itself worsens. So that's why it's on that survey, because the research shows such a strong relationship between noise levels and costs and medical outcomes.
So in this particular area, then, the perception and the reaction of a patient after as they're leaving or after they've left the hospital is really a pretty good indicator, then.
Well, that's a topic of discussion. I won't say controversy, but discussion, because you're right. We're not putting sound level meters and measuring sound pressure level in dB or dBA and making it very quantitative and objective, right? We're not doing that to base the financial reimbursements on. We're asking patients, was it quiet or not? And what's quiet to one patient might not be quiet to another. What's annoying to one patient might not be that quiet to another. And, you know, perhaps they're relying on number of surveys and statistics, adequate sampling to represent the true population. It's controversial how we're not objectifying this, and it's very subjective.
Yeah, I would think so. Do we find that older hospitals have a larger problem with noise than newer ones, or is it really hospital specific in terms of what the noise issues are?
Well, that's a great question. And when we work with older existing hospitals, which are predominantly semi-private rooms, we sort of get this, well, you know, there's only so much we're going to be able to accomplish because, you know, our newest part of our hospital is, you know, 50 years old and it was remodeled 13 years ago. We're not, you know, we're never going to be able to achieve what a brand new facility does. So we started tracking that quietness score because everything's available online. It's completely transparent. I can look up the scores of any hospital. I can look up state averages. I can look up national average. The national quietness score on that national survey is 60, meaning 60% of patients rate that the area around the room was always quiet at night. So what we started doing is, it's very difficult to do this, but we created a list, and it's ever-growing list of new hospitals, ground-up hospitals, not renovations or additions or so forth, expansions. And so we have a list of about 50 new hospitals built within the past 6 years. And their score is not much different than the national average. Sometimes it's 59, sometimes it's 61, depending on when we look at the data. But there's no substantial difference in the quietness rating of a new hospital versus the national average.
So the excuse, we have an old hospital, we can't help it, just really doesn't carry any weight then?
Correct.
Interesting, because I would have thought that it would just been an absolute lock that old hospitals were just generally noisier because they're just more hard surfaces and more concrete block, and that literally there's nothing could be done about it, but not the case. That's really interesting. When we talk about noise, so far all we've talked about is patients. That must also be a factor for workers. I got to believe that noise in general affects workers. I know it does. I'm sure it does you, and it does me when I'm doing my job. Is that an issue, or are they able to deal with it because it's always there?
It's very much an issue. I think that hospital or healthcare workers, whether they're clinical or non-clinical, are exposed to it day in and day out, and they get more accustomed to it. But for example, we did some research with the Moran Group in 2011, and we interviewed a bunch of doctors and nurses. And here's, you know, a couple quick stats. 56% of the nurses responded that noise directly affects the quality of their work. And about the same, 55% said that noise makes it hard for them to concentrate. And this is what we were really surprised at this. While 34% might seem low, 34% of the nurses responded that noise contributed to some mistake made by them or other doctors and nurses. And while 34% might seem low, really think about that, that many, you know, 3 out of 10 definitely relate what's going on noise-wise in the hospital to mistakes being made.
Yeah, that didn't seem low to me. That seemed alarmingly high. That's disturbing, and I'm sure it's disturbing to the healthcare workers because they have no interest in mistakes. That's a huge jump or a huge number. That must be a tough hurdle to overcome to get that 34% down to. I mean, I would think that an expectation would be in the 10 to 15% range.
I don't know. Hopefully, we can, you know, at some point it's zero. But I think it's going to take a lot of work.
What is causing the noise? Where does the noise come from? Is it just people noise? Is it machinery? Is it, you know, building system noise? What are the primary causes?
Part of the complexity is there's so many sources of noise in the healthcare setting. And when we look at historical records of patient complaints, a lot of them focus around talking. Particularly clinical staff, nurses particularly, and particularly non-clinical conversations. So it's the third shift or night shift nurses, you know, it's their day, but it's the patient's night, coming in, talking about their weekend, talking about what they're going to do when they leave. It's those type conversations that top the charts in patient complaints. Equally would be in a semi-private setting, complaints about their roommate. Whether it's snoring or watching TV or talking to the visitors that come to see the roommate, those are the biggies. But what's, you know, also there is what's the medical equipment alarms. And there's tens of thousands of these medical equipment alarms every day throughout a facility. And in fact, the Joint Commission recently issued a sentinel event alert on alarm fatigue. Our government's been tracking the number of deaths associated with alarm fatigue, and that just relates to the number of alarms that are going off. And what's interesting is that of all the alarms, according to the Joint Commission's Sentinel Alert, 85 to 99% of all those alarms are false positives, meaning the window is set too tight on the parameters and it's causing an alarm or the, you know, batteries of the device are low in power or the sensor on the patient has come loose and alarm goes off. There's no medical condition that needs required attention, but the alarms are still going off. So this really, you know, the medical equipment alarms are a big part of that soundscape that, and impacting patients. But even besides the talking and the alarms, there's door slams and ice machines and pneumatic tubes, and I mean, there's a long list of contributing sources.
Those alarms, that was an interesting thing. We have a very close friend who just had brain surgery not too long ago, and I went to visit him. And, of course, he's an extreme case. I mean, he was hooked up to everything they could find in the building. I was really surprised at how much beeping, just constant beeping of everything, to the point where it just became this background din. And when you mention about how 99% of these things are ignored, I can see that. I relate to that because it wasn't long that I was at the hospital, and already I started to realize that all that noise that was irritating me when I first walked in had just quickly dropped to the background. It was just white noise in the background. And if you're a nurse or a doctor, boy, that's the last thing you want if one of those actually means something.
Right. I mean, I had a similar personal experience. My father had heart problems earlier this year. I mean, he's fine now, thank God. But I sat there in the cardiovascular intensive care unit, and he had a VTAC alarm that kept going off, and the nurse would come in and say, "Don't worry about it, you know, something's wrong." And I said, "It's on one hand, it's nice, don't worry about it, but it kept going off." And when I watched my father, this VTAC alarm went off, and you know, his eyes were closed. I don't know if you could really call him sleeping or not, but every time that VTAC alarm went off, which was about every 2 minutes, he tensed, his arms tensed, and his hands shook. So he was responding, even though he was in some phase of sleep, to that alarm. So I was very persistent with that nurse and then a series of other people that I brought in to get that VTAC alarm shut off.
Well, you're a dangerous guy when you have a family member in the hospital.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Every noise you're attuned to. So it wasn't, it truly wasn't anything, or?
True. He was in there for a ventricular rhythm problem, and, I mean, this monitor was indicating a VTAC alert, but it did not need to be going off. Everyone was a false positive, and the nurse tried to come in a couple times and just shut it off, but after a while, I mean, she got tired of it, right? I mean, coming in just to shut this thing off. And what's worse is we heard it not only bedside, right by his head, but then maybe 20 feet away through the open door at the nurse's station, and they weren't synchronized, so we would hear it there and then at the nurse's station and by his head and by the nurse's station, and it just had to be taken care of. And it came down to, and most of these false positives do, that the sensors on his chest need to be replaced. They were on there too long and weren't getting a good connection, so that, you know, eventually after they stopped messing around with the device, they replaced the sensors on his chest and the false positives went away.
Oh, that's absolutely maddening, and I can't even imagine from a healthcare worker perspective. That's just one patient.
Right.
If you have a whole bunch of that stuff going on, that's just, at some point I'd tune it out too.
Right. You can't fault the nurses at all. I mean, it's a serious problem that fortunately the Joint Commission has recognized and our government has recognized, and hospitals are now charged to decrease those false positives.
When it comes to design, environmental design, environment design in healthcare facilities, I read a lot and we cover a lot in the magazine, trying to make healthcare facilities and particularly patient rooms feel more like home and be more home friendly. I gotta believe that helps with acoustics, but is a problem with when it comes to sanitation and germ control, if I can use that crude word, germ. Where are we at with design in terms of acoustics and soft acoustic porous surfaces versus hard, easy to clean surfaces? What is happening with the design, and how are our acoustics affected by or improved by the designs?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is probably one of the biggest misconceptions with noise control in healthcare facilities. I think a lot of people, particularly in the healthcare environment, not so much in the architectural world, or less so in the architectural world, really think that porous, sound-absorbing wall, ceiling, and floor materials are associated with increased risk of nosocomial or hospital acquired infections, and that's just not true. I mean, if in 2003 the CDC and the Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee put out the guidelines for environmental infection control in healthcare facilities, and if you read through that document, you will clearly see that they're not looking, the CDC and this Infection Control Practices Advisory Commission, they're not looking at walls and doors and or I shouldn't say doors, but walls and floors and ceilings. I mean, pathogens in these facilities are primarily transmitted by hand contact. Someone touching something that's contaminated and then going and either touching the patient or something within the patient's reach. That's why you see all these hand sanitation policies and stations throughout a healthcare facility. So you have to look at it as far as likelihood or regular or frequency of contact. So, for example, the ceiling is not a no-contact surface except for facilities when they're doing maintenance of something or another. But, you know, the average person does not contact the ceiling, whether it's clinical or patient or visitor. It's a no-contact surface. It's an excellent place for sound-absorbing materials. And even this report does not have any recommendations meant against carpeted floors. The benefit of acoustically treating the floor with carpet is huge. Again, this report does not say anything against carpeted floors. While, yes, we contact them with our feet, everybody does, it's not with our hands, and that's why. So as you move to the walls, you know, you have to look at it from a likelihood of contact. So something by a curtain, by window, or between beds, or by a toilet, or by a light switch, or by a doorknob, all of those are high contact, like, you know, surfaces, and you wouldn't want something porous and sound absorptive there. But a lot of the other wall surfaces, above door head height, or you know, across from the bed, are not high contact surfaces, and those are fair game as well for sound absorbing materials.
I'm really surprised at the carpet thing. I would have thought that carpet was absolutely verboten in a healthcare facility, just because it's just a surface that can collect dirt and spills and all kinds of things. But in hallways and other areas where I'm sure it makes a huge difference sound wise, then that's not been an issue then.
Correct. I mean, basically, if you read through this report and other research, you reach the conclusion that the floor is contaminated, whether it's carpet or a hard surface. It gets contaminated quickly after cleaning. I mean, you just can't clean either one enough. But it's a low contact surface from a hand's point of view. And again, there's nothing out there supporting a relationship between floor, wall, and ceiling materials and nosocomial infections. In fact, here in Chicago, Rush University recently opened up a huge expansion, and I went on a tour and I listened to the nurse researchers say that they were charged with scouring any available research on this topic and making a recommendation on whether there should be sound absorbing materials or not. They found nothing. Therefore, Rush's new hospital expansion has carpeted floors in the nurse's station, in the aisles, not in the patient rooms, obviously, and highly sound absorptive ceiling tiles throughout.
And have their scores, noise scores, shown that has given them a vast improvement? Is it significant, or maybe you haven't had a chance to look at them?
Yeah, haven't had a chance to look at them simply because there's a lag, right? After a facility opens, well, there's two reasons. You sort of have to be open a year before your data actually gets online. And that facility has not been, it'll be open a year in January of 2014, so they don't even have a complete year of data to report yet. And what also makes this more confusing is that you get an entire facility score. So the score of the old part of Rush's hospital and the score of the new part, as far as a public reporting, gets all combined into one. So it's sort of an average. Now, the hospital is most likely looking at scores unit by unit. And, you know, if we were to be able to look at the unit by unit data, we might be able to tell a difference. But you can't with the publicly reported data.
That's unfortunate, because it seems that would be a classic place to study the difference between old and new, and what new designs can really do for noise. That's too bad that it gets combined.
True, but, you know, that's one of the reasons, again, why we're keeping that list now up to 50 new ground-up hospitals, because those aren't getting combined with any older parts of the facility, and it's not showing a significant improvement.
What when it comes to design, what are some of the materials, what are some of the tricks of the trade that you can use? Obviously, carpet would make a huge difference. I got to believe one of the biggest impact items is acoustic ceiling tiles and material. What other things can be done to keep noise down in the hallways, in any of the areas?
Well, I mean, noise reduction is part of the overall goal. It's a big part, right? But you really want to look at the overall soundscape of the hospital. And, you know, there's evidence-based design research and literature out there, and that simply means show me the evidence that what you're proposing, whatever intervention, architectural, policy, procedures, whatever, show me the evidence that what you're proposing is actually going to decrease cost or decrease time, increase efficiency, or improve medical outcomes. So if you sort of review that evidence-based design literature, they have 8 priority recommendations for improving the healthcare experience and medical outcomes. 3 of those are acoustical. So that's a pretty high percentage. The first one that's acoustical is conduct a noise audit and implement a noise reduction plan. And that's what we do through our Making Hospitals Quiet Service program. The second one is install high-performing sound-absorptive ceiling tiles. So by high-performing, they're talking about a high NRC, perhaps a minimum of 0.9 or higher, 90% absorptive, such as those available by Rockfon. And the third one is use music as a positive distraction, good sounds. And a good example of that is the Care Channel by Healing Healthcare Systems. They produce music specifically for the healing environment and accompany that with nature scenes and bring that bedside to the patient. So you're not just thinking about the pain, but you're being distracted by in a positive way, that this music. So, you know, those are the three priority recommendations through evidence-based design related to acoustics. But it's, you know, it's sort of a comprehensive solution that's best. I mean, you have to look at the structure and systems in the hospital itself. You know, how do patients report noise, and how do you address that real time with the patient while it's happening or shortly thereafter? And how do you track that historically so that a noise committee or someone in charge of sound quality in the hospital can look back and say, hey, you know what, last quarter we had 57 complaints about door slams, and we're going to implement a change, and next quarter we want to make sure that that's down below 10 complaints about door slams. So you have to set these systems up in place, and you have to create a written plan, an actionable plan, not some big document that nobody wants to read. What we do is we really liken noise prevention to infection prevention, right? With infection prevention, you have somebody or a small team that's accountable and responsible. And there's an action plan, and there's specific policies and procedures about it. Noise prevention shouldn't be any different, but you know, that's one of the things we work with hospitals. It's sort of a paradigm shift, a different way of thinking about noise reduction.
When you talked about introducing nature sounds into a patient room, that tells me then that the goal in terms of noise reduction and acoustics, the goal is not dead silence then. It's much different than that.
Very much so. In fact, you know, we call it chasing silence. And again, it's part of this paradigm shift. You know, silence is not the goal. It's not desired, and it's not achievable. Silence can be very concerning, particularly to a patient. You know, the higher the acuity, the more the concern. And what most people think is that I'm trying to decrease sound pressure levels. I'm trying to, you know, go from 45 dB or dBA to 35 to 30 to 20. And the lower that sound pressure level is, the better off I am. And that's not true. What hospitals are doing is they're saying, okay, here's a bad noise. All these carts need to, the caster's replaced, and they do that. And let's stop paging or let's decrease public paging. And what they're doing is creating a little bit longer periods of silence, maybe 1 minute, maybe 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. But in between that, little bits of silence are unavoidable noises, and the silence before and after them creates a more annoying perception of what's unavoidable. So we say stop chasing the silence, and you have to realize that quiet from the patient's perception is when good sounds are louder than bad noises. And you mentioned nature sounds, but I mentioned more music specifically designed for the healing environment. And there's other good sounds, such as sound masking, and you know that there's different sources for that masking sound. But when those are consistent and loud, and a little bit louder than the bad noises that you can't avoid, that's when a patient says, "This is quiet." You know, a good example is ocean waves. You know, go on vacation, get a hotel on the beach, open up the balcony doors, and lay there and take a nap listening to the ocean waves, right? If I were to take a sound level meter in that hotel room, I guarantee you it's going to be loud, probably louder than the hospital environment. But it's soothing, and people relate it as quiet because that ocean wave sound is masking, you know, the TV in the next room or other people walking down the hotel corridor.
We're recording this during the Christmas holidays here, and our son and daughter are visiting us, and they have a new puppy. And when you talk about introducing sounds, good sounds that overwhelm bad sounds, it makes me wonder, does that apply with animals too, or is that an unfair question to ask you?
Well, I have a one-year-old puppy at home too. I guess 1 year's not a puppy anymore, but at times, particularly at night when it wants attention, it will, you know, whine and bark, and inevitably I turn a fan on, and that consistent sound helps cover up that dog bark and allows me to sleep. So it's the same concept of a good sound. A lot of people sleep with fans on. You know, whenever I'm presenting publicly, I always ask the question, how many people sleep with a fan on? And it's always, you know, a quarter to half of the people. And it's not because they're cold. It's because that consistent background sound masks noise, you know, abrupt or transient noises that would wake them up.
I mean, there are spaces in a hospital where you can only have hard surfaces. Do you just simply have to deal with that? I mean, I got to believe in operating rooms and some other areas, there are just really not good opportunities for significant sound masking or sound absorbing materials. Is there anything can be done there, or is that something that you just have to deal with?
Well, you know, it's a multi-legged stool supporting this, right? And one, as you mentioned, is definitely the facility, the architectural layout, the construction, the surface materials, and the systems that go in it, the communication systems, the HVAC systems. You know, so that's one leg of the stool. And then there's hospital policies and procedures. And then the third would be just personal culture, organizational culture, and personal behavior. And when you don't have good opportunity with one of those variables, it just places greater emphasis on the other. So when I can do less with the facility, I have to do more with policies and procedures and culture behavior. But, you know, a good example of where porous or sound-absorbing materials are not allowed is where clinically immunosuppressed patients are, like an oncology unit. So typically you will see gypsum board ceilings and no carpeting, and because of the sensitive nature of their immune systems. But overall, the percentage of area, whether that's floor area or total surface area in a healthcare facility where you can't have sound-absorbing materials is very small. Most areas you can have porous sound-absorbing materials, again, as long as you're thinking about it in terms of hand contact and pathogen transfer.
Where are we headed with this sound absorption, acoustics? What's the future, 5 years out, 10 years out, or is there more work to be done? Is there more technology that looks promising that will improve things and make it less of a human intervention type thing? What do you see on the horizon for this?
We're still very much in the learning stage. What we're finding is some of the common practices in the acoustics world outside of healthcare facilities don't quite transfer in well. And a good example is a measurement metric. You know, you read some of the research that is more quantitative, and they've gone in and measured nighttime dBA levels, which is just an A-weighted dBA. So they measured sound for 8 hours, and it was, 45 dBA. And they implement some change, and they didn't really notice a significant difference in that number, and they're reaching the wrong conclusion. So we're actually trying to develop a different metric, because I can guarantee you I can create a soundscape in a healing environment that measures 55 dBA, and most patients or people are going to perceive that as more quiet than one that is perhaps 35 dBA or 30 dBA long term. So we're trying to create measurements that don't quite exist yet that really look at the dynamics of the sound field. We mentioned periods of silence, and then a door slam is more disruptive. Nice, even, consistent, good sounds that's perceived as quiet. But beyond that, I think we're going to see, even though I think it's going to be a slow change, is a greatly different approach to alarms, particularly because of the sentinel alert and focus on alarm fatigue. Right now, It makes no sense to have audible medical equipment alarms in the patient room by the patient's head, because they're the only ones that don't need to hear it. In fact, we're working with the Ministry of Health in Singapore. They've got 15 public hospitals, and they do not have medical equipment alarms in the patient room. It's monitored remotely at the nurse's station, and they keep their patient room door closed. And we say, well, why do you do that? I mean, we all know the answer. They said, well, it gives them more privacy and allows them to sleep and recover faster. So I think the U.S. will be heading in that direction. But I think it's going to be, a longer timeline. But I think at some point, hopefully, by the time I'm sort of in retirement and in higher likelihood of hospitalization, I won't hear medical equipment alarms. That would be great, but that might be 10 years out. Another example is on a technology basis. Really what's happened in the past is if you want to measure sound levels in a healthcare facility, you have to go out and buy an expensive sound level meter. You have to train somebody, one of your staff who's not an acoustic consultant or engineer, how to use it. And they have to operate it, and they have to download the data and then interpret it and put it in some sort of spreadsheet. There's a new technology out there called QuietTime, and it's a remote monitoring system. And it's priced at a point where you could feasibly have a noise monitor in every patient room, every corridor, every nurse's station, and it uploads sound levels wirelessly to a cloud, and then anybody in the hospital or someone you're working with, like making hospitals quiet, can log onto a web page, see a floor plan of your facility, and look at real-time noise levels second by second. And that system sends out alerts via emails or texts and creates reporting, dashboards or more in-depth reports, depending on who's meant to look at it. So I see that as and that's hitting the streets now. That's not a 10 years out. That's in fact, we're working with some hospitals next month to get this installed. So I think the other thing is you're going to see more individual control at the patient bedside. You know, we talked a little bit about sound masking. A good example is Logison sound masking systems, and we talked about the care channel with Healing Healthcare Systems. I think in the not so distant, I think the technology is already there, but there's always a lag between workable technology and acceptance of that technology, particularly in the healthcare industry. But for example, Logison sound masking in the care channel by Healing Healthcare Systems, I think we're going to see individual control at the patient bedside. And evidence-based design shows us that satisfaction is highly related to the control of the environment, whether it's temperature, acoustics, or whatever. When we have control and we don't feel like we have no control, we're much more satisfied. So I think those are some of the places where this is, where technology and general trends are taking us.
Now, that's really interesting, because a couple of solutions you just mentioned just seem, once you state them, they're just so logical.
Yes.
Which is to remove the alarms from the patient room, because your statement that the last person that needs to hear the alarm is the patient.
Right.
And then to give the patient some control those are just so logical. And yet, as you said, it'll be a while to get them implemented and to close the door. I mean, it just seems so basic. That's what we do all the time when we want quiet.
Right.
And
there's just this very significant barrier in the statement, that's the way we've always done it.
Yes.
You ask, well, why are the patient room doors always left open? Why don't you close them? Well, that's the way we always do it. I mean, there's no reason. It's just it's always been done that way. And that's a significant barrier to break through. And what it usually takes is numerous examples of other facilities, whether it's in the United States or Singapore or Kuala Lumpur or wherever, of other healthcare systems that do it and have done it that way. And people think, well, I guess if he's got good examples of where it's being done successfully without any problems other places, then my defense sort of goes away.
The way we've always done it, one of the great barriers to progress.
Right, right.
Yeah. Gary, I really appreciate the time here. We need to wrap this up. That's enlightening stuff. I just find all of it absolutely fascinating. And for those listening to the podcast, Gary has put together several resources. They're on the page for the podcast at commercialconversation.com. Several resources so you can gain more information from him. And also, he's quoted liberally in an article in the January-February issue of Commercial Building Products talking about healthcare environments. So, Gary, we really appreciate it, and thanks for the insights.
You're quite welcome. If my passion for this hasn't come through, it's there and real, and we're Rockfon and Making Hospitals Quiet are there to help folks out there, and we'd be happy to answer any emails or phone calls or come visit, help in any way we can.
Appreciate that. Links to all of that on that Comcast pay or Comcast Commercial Conversation page. And with that, we'll wrap up Commercial Conversation number 14. Thanks for listening.